Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. Today, Rebecca Anshel's song returns with more of a great talk on America's bizarre standards of beauty. This week, she gives us a new way of looking at the war on obesity. Fat chance, you say? Stay tuned and find out. We return to Rebecca Anshel's song's fascinating talk about our culture's oddball standards of human beauty, and about the social, political, and especially economic forces that are perpetuating these oddball standards, and that are profiting from these oddball standards. I like Song's perspective a lot. She shows that you can't just talk about sexism and looksism without talking about that other ism, that taboo ism whose name we hesitate to speak aloud in polite company, capitalism. For instance, she notes that we now have a corporate-controlled, for-profit medical industry. One big and growing branch of this industry is the for-profit cosmetic surgery business. Everyone in this business has a strong vested interest in you hating the way your body looks. Not only are breast implants commonplace now, a growing trend now is female genital mutilation. Right here in America, we're not talking about Ethiopia. More and more American women now don't like the look of their genitals and are paying big bucks for surgery so their crotch looks like Barbie's. In fact, that's the name of a particular procedure, the Barbie. So far, men have resisted the temptation to have a surgeon make their crotch look more like Ken's. But I'm sure the day will come. You're having a Barbie? Great! I'll go get a Ken to match. But it's not just the plastic surgeons. It's also the weight loss doctors, and the diet food industry, and the mainstream food industry, and the clothing industry, and the media industry, and the pharmaceutical industry, and on and on and on. The more you dislike your body, the richer everybody gets. Except you. This week, in part two of her talk, Song focuses on obesity. In all honesty, I've never been engaged in the issues of fat oppression or obesity rights. That's someone else's problem, and life is too short to fight in every crusade that comes along, I figured. But Rebecca Anshel's song managed to really interest me in the subject. She brilliantly connects the war on obesity with many other forces in our society, with for-profit medicine, with the corruption of our food system by its owners, with the increasing exploitation of workers for the sake of greater and greater profits, and in general, with the class war that the 1% is waging against the 99%. As she sees it, the war on obesity is another example of blaming the victims while the criminals get off scot-free. No offense to the Scots. It all adds up, and it all makes sense, and I think it's a great listen. I hope you do too. Once again, live from Chicago, here is Rebecca Anshel's song.
Although objectification of women's bodies has been an issue since at least the early part of the 20th century, it should come as no surprise that we've seen a dramatic increase in this objectification since the 1980s, going along with a right-wing and ruling class backlash to the women's movement. In the last several years, however, this focus on women's bodies has actually expanded to include an intensified effort to shame fat people in general and to blame all manner of social problems on an increase in average body weight. And so at this point, I want to kind of shift my focus to and take a critical look at what's called the war on obesity. So the common narrative around the war on obesity goes something like this. Due to a massive epidemic of laziness and lack of control, People in the U.S. are becoming fatter. As a result of this, they are contracting serious diseases, draining the healthcare resources of the country, and tearing down the moral fabric of our society. And, of course, you know, most people do view this as primarily an issue of personal responsibility. So obviously, you know, if people just had the willpower to eat right and exercise, get the right number of calories in versus calories out, the problem will be solved, right? But this ignores a glaring elephant in the room. Why did tens of millions of people suddenly, at the same time, wake up and become lazy and fat when apparently their grandparents weren't? And so the reality is much more complicated than that. In the medical community and in the media, obesity is typically described as an epidemic. Mm-hmm. So the same terminology that's used for the H1N1 virus or cholera. As Amy Farrell put it in her book, Fat Shame, with its connotations of disease, contagion, and proliferation, the choice of the term epidemic is deliberately alarmist, suggesting imminent danger and sure catastrophe if not addressed. Mm-hmm. And in fact, just last week, the American Medical Association decided to take this one step further and classify obesity as a disease. Interestingly, in doing this, the AMA delegates actually overrode the recommendation of a committee tasked with studying the issue. So the AMA's Council on Science and Public Health, which had been studying the issue over the last year, said that obesity should not be considered a disease, mainly because the measure usually used to define obesity, the body mass index, the BMI, is simplistic and flawed. Mm-hmm. They noted that some people with a BMI above the level that usually defines obesity are perfectly healthy, while others below it can have dangerous levels of body fat or metabolic problems. And they also mentioned that the classification of obesity as a disease, conveniently, could cause increased pressure on the FDA to more quickly approve weight loss drugs. Nonetheless, in the face of these recommendations from the committee, the AMA decided to go ahead and classify obesity a disease and effectively label one-third of the U.S. population as sick. Remarkably, the AMA's decision comes in a period in which a number of scientists have raised major questions about the assumption that increases in body weight have actually been the cause of other health problems. Paul Campos and other researchers have argued that a relationship between body mass and mortality only exists at the extreme ends of the spectrum, so a far smaller number of people than are currently labeled overweight, and that it's equally dangerous whether they have an extremely low body mass index or extremely high. Even among the studies that do show increased mortality risk, they typically don't control for fitness level, amount of exercise, diet quality, weight cycling, diet drug use, or family history, all of which have, you know, major impacts on an individual's health. So it is, in fact, very difficult to place any clear causation for medical problems with body weight itself. Campos, Abigail Segui, and others also argued in a 2006 edition of the International Journal of Epidemiology that the premise, which is assumed by so many, that long-term weight loss will improve health, can't even be tested because there has not been any method found that can consistently produce long-term weight loss. So there's no way to know if that would actually help people get healthier because it can't be done so far. Dieting, on the other hand, and particularly yo-yo dieting, does have proven medical risks. Right. These same researchers singled out financial interests in the industry as a major factor in the way the supposed obesity epidemic is being evaluated. So in the same IJE article, the author said, many of the leading obesity researchers who have created the official standards for what constitutes overweight and obese have also received sizable funding from the pharmaceutical and weight loss industries. These obesity researchers also manage weight loss clinics and have an economic interest in defining unhealthy weight as broadly as possible by overstating the hazards of obesity and thus providing justifications for regulatory approvals as well as for government and insurance industry subsidization of their products. The fact of the matter is that even though people expect that doctors will be more conservative and careful in their approaches, a section of the medical industry has actually endorsed and profited from some of the most dangerous methods of weight loss that exist. Between 1993 and 1997, diet doctors and pharmaceutical executives across the U.S. made a killing on selling Fen-Phen, a drug which eventually caused many people to have pulmonary hypertension and heart valve problems. Diet doctors in nearly every city set up weight loss clinics where they wrote prescriptions for the drug to just about anyone who asked for it. today fen-phen is banned, but there are new drugs with their own potential side effects to take its place. In addition, something like 200,000 people every year are undergoing risky and invasive bariatric surgery, which is extremely profitable for the healthcare industry, but also carries a number of very serious potential complications for the people who undergo it. I'm not a medical expert myself, and so I don't feel qualified to sort of state definitively whether or not body fat directly causes health problems, but I am confident in saying that there's an enormous amount of evidence that the methods that are being used to address an increase in body weight at best don't really work, and at worst are actually quite harmful to the people that are using them. I think it's worth questioning whether it makes sense to continue to recommend to people that the best thing they can do for their health is to lose weight when there's an enormous amount of evidence that dieting and eating disorders are extremely harmful and that very few people actually succeed in keeping the weight off long term. Where there is broader agreement in the scientific community, it is in the fact that people's weight on average has been increasing. So, you know, to take a look, you know, for a minute at what might be behind that, I think it's not entirely clear, but outside of sort of, you know, this narrative of people just eating too much, there are a number of factors that are often completely ignored or just brushed over. Perhaps most importantly, we need to be clear that obesity and also diabetes, high cholesterol, et cetera, are all most prevalent in high poverty communities. The rich in this country obviously have boundless access to healthy food, good health care, not to mention things like personal trainers, personal chefs, and on and on. But for people who are struggling to make ends meet, the cheapest food available is often the least healthy. The Food Research and Action Center, FRAC, has some really good resources on this, and they identify several factors contributing to health problems among the poor, including lack of access to healthy food, both because it's expensive and because there are less stores with fresh foods and produce in low-income neighborhoods, cycles of food deprivation and overeating, because when people have food insecurity, once they get money for food, they often overeat, and that inconsistent diet can directly lead to obesity. Mothers are particularly susceptible to this because they will often go longer periods without eating sufficiently in order to feed their children. Limited access to health care and high levels of stress. And I think, you know, we can add to that list the effects of austerity, which has meant the cutting of enormous amounts of critical food resources for poor families and increased pressure on working people to work longer and longer hours, and also the impact of sexism, which of course increases stress. So there are a number of broad economic and social trends that are likely contributing to increasing body weights and other health problems. Rather than actually looking at the systematic ways in which working people's health is under attack, though, most discussions about fat place an enormous amount of blame on individuals, thus detracting attention from the people who really have control over the situation. Meanwhile, this blame and stigma placed on working class people for their health problems or their body size has real effects on people's lives. For one thing, fat people face a large amount of discrimination in a variety of venues. Healthcare is often tainted for people who are overweight. Often doctors will prescribe weight loss as a solution to nearly any physical problem, which means that actual treatment is often deferred or not given to the patient. Self-report studies show that a large percentage of doctors view fat patients as lazy, lacking in self-control, non-compliant, unintelligent, weak-willed, and dishonest. A study of nurses found that 31% said they prefer not to care for obese patients and 24% said that obese patients repulse them. As a result, many fat people are reluctant to seek medical care at all or will delay important preventative care in order to avoid entering a situation where they feel like they're going to experience discrimination. It happens in the workplace as well. Fat women in particular have been shown to get fewer promotions and lower pay than their thinner counterparts. There have also been a growing number of employee wellness programs that penalize employees for not losing weight or adhering to a variety of health standards. Typically, there are increased costs for healthcare for people who don't comply with those rules. And the pressure on children in particular has been very intense over the last few years. And this is magnified by Michelle Obama's campaign against childhood obesity. Mm-hmm. she frequently invokes nasty stereotypes about fat people to make her point, mm-hmm. saying things directed at parents like, we can't lie around on the couch eating French fries and candy bars. She has also said that childhood obesity is a public health threat, an economic threat, and a national security threat. I'm not really sure what that means. I mean, maybe fat kids are more likely to support Al-Qaeda. You know, even though her campaign has included some, you know, modest legislation to increase food support to low-income families, which is helpful, the impact of the blame she puts on families and individuals is significant. Mm-hmm. In schools over the last several years, there's been growing pressure to enforce body size standards among children. Mm-hmm. Just this year, schools in Andover, Massachusetts sent home fat letters to any family whose student they consider to be obese, a step that obviously further shames and stigmatizes children who are already under an enormous amount of social pressure to lose weight. And we already know that this approach doesn't help people improve their health. Ultimately, the result of blaming and stigmatizing fat people is more disordered eating and more health problems. The effect is particularly stark for women. So I spoke earlier about the way many, many women are obsessed with their weight. For millions of women, this takes the extreme of severe eating disorders. At least 10 million women in the U.S. have anorexia or bulimia. Mm-hmm. And anorexia actually has the highest premature fatality rate of any mental illness. Around 20% of anorexics will die from complications related to the disorder, including suicide and heart failure. And this is an epidemic, by the way, that's largely being ignored by the government. So research dollars spent on anorexia average 70 cents per affected individual, compared to $159 per individual for schizophrenia. So you can see a bit of a disparity. This is a major problem for young women, but research and treatment is barely being funded. Even beyond the more extreme eating disorders, tens of millions of other women spend an enormous part of their lives in the yo-yo cycle of losing weight and gaining it back over and over again. At any given moment, 50% of American women are on a diet. And this is linked to a number of health effects on its own, and it obviously perpetuates the stress and low self-esteem that ultimately leads some in the direction of full-blown eating disorders, or depression, or suicide. In addition, when officials like Michelle Obama talk about the role of families in properly feeding their children, it's mothers who still primarily bear the responsibility of feeding children in the majority of families. As Natalie Boero argues, implicit in this critique of American culture is a blame of working mothers for allowing their children to watch too much television, for not having their eating habits more closely monitored, and for relying on convenience food for meals. This, of course, is tied to a broader attempt to shame mothers for working as opposed to staying home and cooking and cleaning and raising children. Some media outlets are more obvious in making this argument, like the British Daily Mail, which published an article not long ago titled, "Children with Working Mothers Are 6 times More Likely to Be Fat." So, pretty obvious. So when we really examine it, the war on obesity is really a thinly veiled method for reinforcing individual responsibility, particularly the responsibility of women, and taking away attention from the people who really make the core decisions about what food and health care we have access to. And it's going to be up to us to build an alternative explanation and a plan of action that actually places the blame for the health care crisis where it belongs and demands better living conditions for everyone. So with that, I want to kind of finish up by talking about what those solutions might actually look like. Typically, people who have written on these topics take one of two approaches to counteracting the problems within our food system or with women's body image. So the first approach is one often promoted by healthy food advocates, which calls for people to essentially retake control over their food. And this ranges from growing your own gardens to buying organic to cooking all of your meals at home. Now, there's little doubt that those things can lead people to have healthier diets. But the big glaring problem is that none of those options are incredibly accessible to the majority of people who have to devote most of their waking hours to working. This method also doesn't really stand a fighting chance at taking down the massive capitalists that currently control the food system. And so while this may be something that is fulfilling for some individuals, it falls short as a strategy for a mass movement. The second approach is more common among feminists who write on the topic of body image, as well as a lot of fat activists. and that is the love your body approach. The idea is that, you know, we should educate ourselves and each other to get past the cultural expectations of beauty and really learn to love and appreciate our bodies. This is great. You know, I would celebrate anyone reaching that level of acceptance of themselves. But again, this is primarily an individual solution, and it really relies on each of us managing to bypass a constant barrage of pressure on our bodies rather than actually dismantling the institutions that produce that pressure to begin with. And one other thing I'll say about the body acceptance approach is that it kind of leaves the door open to corporations trying to profit off of selling us on loving our bodies. Mm-hmm. So Dove's Real Beauty campaign is a great example of that. Mm-hmm. They produce commercials and images that are supposed to challenge the mainstream account of beauty, but then the same company that owns Dove, Unilever, also produces a litany of products that directly reinforce those beauty expectations and sexism, like Axe body spray. Women's magazines also play on this. So at the beginning of this talk, I mentioned a Glamour magazine survey on body image. And in that article on body image, they included various tips to improving your own body image. But at the same time, if you look at their website, there are a bunch of links to other articles like The Surprising Way Flossing Can Help You Lose Weight, How to Get These Abs Without Doing Crunches, and my personal favorite, How to Eat Cheese and Not Get Fat. Thank God, I want to eat cheese for so long. So, obviously many activists who promote body acceptance don't want anything to do with these ridiculous sort of corporate attempts to co-opt this message. So it's not as though these are equivalent, but at the end of the day, anything that's fundamentally based on individual transformation can also be very easily commodified. And it's much harder to do that with a mass movement that actually confronts profit. So what can we put forward as some solutions, both to the very unhealthy nature of our food system and to the pervasive sexism that makes women feel horrible about themselves? One thing we can fight for immediately is universal single-payer healthcare that ensures that people's actual needs come before profit in the health system. Beyond just helping people get healthier, this would go a long way towards counteracting the segment of the medical industry that is currently profiting massively off of diet drugs and invasive surgeries, as well as the plastic surgery industry, which is in a constant drive for more patients and increased profits. We can also fight for access to healthy food as a human right, which means opposing austerity measures that attack food stamps or community nutrition programs, but also demanding more. Everyone should have easy, affordable access to fruits, vegetables, and other foods that are high in nutritional value. We need to build a women's movement that calls out sexism for what it is and directly challenges the media images and the industries built around making us feel ashamed of our bodies. A mass movement can effectively challenge the objectification of women, whether in media, on the street, or in the workplace. And frankly, that kind of movement probably will have the effect of helping a lot of us to feel better about ourselves, not only about our bodies, but also about what we can actually achieve in this world. Ultimately, of course, I think the best thing we could do would be to overthrow capitalism. And while there are many other sessions this weekend dealing with revolution and how that works, I will say that there are a number of common sense things that we could do if we had the opportunity to actually make decisions about our lives. We could organize communal kitchens, allowing people to eat healthfully with less effort, expense, and time. We could organize communal daycare and education that is based much more on play and gives children a chance to use their bodies and learn through movement. Communal kitchens and daycare would also, of course, go a long way towards dismantling the sexist division of labor that still dominates women's lives today. And really, that's just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, we can reverse the attacks on women and on working people, but it's going to take a hard-fought struggle against the people who are currently profiting off of our misery. So here's to hoping that we win this soon and that the diet industry gets left in the dustbin of history.
That was Rebecca Anshel Song, speaking in Chicago in June 2013. One question that pops into my mind is, who the heck is Rebecca Anshel Song? I don't know either. At least, I don't know much. The persona she created in her talk is a nice one indeed. Sharp, witty, politically aware, able to connect a whole lot of things in an interesting way. Is she fat? I have no idea. She sure is smart, though. She used to be associated with San Diego State University. Now she lives in Redmond, Washington, near Seattle. She's part of a group called the Puget Sound Socialists. That's it. That's all I know. Whoever she is, I'd love to hear more from her. What we did hear was a talk titled Sexism and the Food and Diet Industry. But as you've heard, the talk is much broader than that. I have lightly edited the audio for radio broadcast. Thanks to wearemany.org for the original recording. And thank you for listening to New World Notes. We come to you from the spacious underground studios of WWUH-FM, a community service of that beacon of light in darkest Connecticut, the University of Hartford. Check out our website, including its archive of broadcasts on MP3. That website is newworldnotes.blogspot.com. On behalf of the entire New World Notes staff, that is me, myself, and our foreign correspondent, moi, on behalf of the entire staff, this is Kenneth Doust, advising illegitimi non carborundum, and hoping you'll tune in again next week. Ciao.